Check engine light on? Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Birdland Today. Your daily dose of Orioles talk.
Man, I'm looking forward to talking to our very first guest out of the chute today. We are going to talk a little baseball. Our friend, Mr. Josh Soroka, being a lifelong Orioles fan, we're going to get to that in just a second here. But first, I just want to say it is busy times in the Mike O'Mara Show world. Very, very busy times because so much going on. If you are a listener of the show, even casually, I urge you to stay tuned within the next few days. Lots of news will be coming through the pipeline. And if you're a bonus show subscriber or you haven't decided to pull the plug, this might be the bonus show that you want to check into. So
big news.
Be aware of that. Yes. That'll be happening later this week. But before we do that, before we talk about everything we have on the show today, we're going to talk a little baseball. And we're going to talk to an author. This gentleman is John W. Miller. This is the book I'm holding in my hand right now. It's called The Last Manager. There's the graphic up there. Now, Earl Weaver, I can't begin to tell you how much of a fan I am. Let's bring in John right now, a journalist, author of The Last Manager, and John has reported from over 40 countries for The Wall Street Journal and has written for Time, NPR, The Baltimore Sun, and it's time to talk about weird being a Red Sox fan and wanting this man as my manager through my formative years watching who I believe was the single greatest entertaining manager in the whole wide world. I have gone through the last two decades of occasionally revisiting some of Earl Weaver's greatest arguments. And much like the lack of personality in so much of sport now with I use the PGA Tour as an example with these kind of robotic guys that don't have the sizzle they used to have. It's kind of the same thing with managers in baseball now where you've got these, they call them players coaches that have don't have the same kind of sizzle. Yeah. Last one I can remember that was really great at it that managed probably Jim Leyland and Lou Piniella before him. But John is here, and John, this book, The Last Manager, I couldn't agree with the title more. The Last Manager, because he was the guy. Earl was just the most entertaining person in the world. This must have been a fun book to both research and to write, I would think.
It was a lot of fun. And a friend of mine, when I started it, he said, you know, who knew Earl? He said, Earl was funny, so make sure your book is funny.
Yeah.
And I think it's a funny book. I think you're absolutely right. He was one of the last great showmen in baseball. Baseball is not as entertaining as it used to be. People like that don't exist anymore within the game because it's too much money. It's too corporate. Yep. He was a free spirit and an original thinker and also a pioneer in baseball strategy. He was the first manager to use data in the dugout in a way that's now common. He was the first manager to use a radar gun, which is a story not a lot of people know. So younger fans might see the YouTube clips of him ranting and raving. This was a serious scholar of the game, a serious person in baseball history, and arguably the greatest manager of all time. He still has the highest winning percentage of any manager.
There's the key.
With over 1,000 wins since divisional play. And he was a winner. And there's no book without the winning. He's just a clown, you know?
Yeah, and I think that when you talk about Earl Weaver, everybody knows the argument. You're absolutely right about that. But one of the things that was amazing to me that I discovered in this book was that Earl Weaver was Moneyball before Moneyball.
Yeah.
And the fact of the book, I think, is that what jumped out is the fact that he used a radar gun before anybody. And it's hard to think even of Little League. I was watching my son's Little League, and I live in Fort Myers, Florida, which is a baseball centric place down here. And the major league Little League kids have radar guns on them now. And to do that, and then to use the stats that he had, but he also had a great gut, great instincts. Isn't that right?
He had a yearning for an edge. I mean, he was coming from a culture that was a street culture, that was a gambling culture. He grew up in 1930s, 1940s, St. Louis. His uncle, who was kind of a father figure, was a bookie. He was somebody who was just trying to beat you at golf, at poker, at baseball, at horse racing. He owned horses after he retired. So he came out of this a more urban American culture, a more like a wise guy almost. I mean, his uncle was kind of in the mob, and Earl, he had a dark side to him. He had a kind of like hustling side. And that came from that upbringing in St. Louis in the 1930s.
I want to ask, when you say kind of in the mob, isn't that leading a little bit pregnant? Isn't it sort of that? Is it all in or all out?
You're right. But I think what people forget is that there was this huge part of the informal economy that's now managed by corporations. I mean, in the case of gambling, I mean, now it's FanDuel and DraftKings. But back then, it was kind of the mob. And they usually didn't kill anybody. They were usually guys on the street who'd take your bet and pay out after the game. So it was a gentler, kinder mob. But his uncle was absolutely he was affiliated with Al Capone. I mean, this guy was no joke. Oh. I mean, he once got drunk and shot his wife in the hip. He was kind of a nasty character.
And Earl didn't do that.
No, Earl had a dad who was a good guy, and the uncle was not a good guy. And so Earl, he was a complicated guy. What makes such a great character is that he was kind of Shakespearean in that he encompassed everything. He was a showman. He was an intellectual, but he was also coarse. He was also crude. He had a drinking problem. He was very funny. He could play music. He played the ukulele. He loved poodles. I mean, this is a complete, man in full. He loved the garden. He had famous tomato growing contest in the 1970s with his groundskeeper, Pat Santarone. So this is like
they actually, for those of you that don't know this, in Memorial Stadium, there were tomatoes growing out in, was it right or left field? I forgot where they had the tomato down in left field. One of the facts I want you to talk about here, when you talk about the fact that he was drinking, and not unlike a lot of managers of the day and the era that he grew up in, smoking was, something that everybody did. But Earl, even later on, wouldn't he duck down the tunnel to grab a smoke many times during the game?
He smoked a cigarette every half inning.
Oh my God!
It was so extreme that the Orioles clubhouse guy sewed a special pocket inside his uniform to keep his pack of cigarettes. And if you go to Camden Yards and there's a statue of Earl Weaver there, he's one of the five Orioles legends, along with Jim Palmer, Cal Ripken, Eddie Murray, and Frank Robinson and Brooks Robinson. So six of them. Anyway, the statue of Earl, you can see the outline of the pocket. The sculptor put that there, the cigarette pocket. This is coming out of a culture of bars and honky tonks and 1930s America. I mean, this is a rough and tumble guy.
When an author says complicated, John, that usually means there are multiple layers and maybe some troubled personality traits in there. He was a complicated guy. He was he had an interesting life. He had an interesting personal life. Talk about the non-baseball part of the man, his personal world. Were there any things that jumped out at you that you found surprising when you were digging into the man as a whole?
I mean, I didn't know about the uncle and about his uncle being a bookie. So the fact that he came out of gambling culture made a lot of sense to me because that basically is analytics. I mean, the way that bookies try to get an edge on people taking bets is how Sabermetrics analytics thinks about baseball today. So I didn't know any of that. Like a lot of baseball relationships and marriages, his first one failed miserably because he was never home.
Right.
His grandson, by the way, this is fun, is a St. Louis musician who goes by Clownvis, who has an act. He's half clown, half Elvis. And I definitely recommend YouTube.
I'm not aware of that one. That's pretty amazing.
He was once on America's Got Talent. And he was so bad, he got into a shouting match with Piers Morgan, who's one of the judges. And so he stormed off the stage. And then after Earl died, he wrote this very sweet piece where he said, I was channeling you, Grandpa, when I told the judges, to go F themselves. That was like you and the umpires.
That's great. Awesome. We're talking with John W. Miller. The book is The Last Manager. It's How Earl Weaver Tricked, Tormented, and Reinvented Baseball. Give me one of the tricked aspects. It was kind of, I think you're referring to maybe how he got into the managerial business in the first place, but you explain it to me.
That's a good question. The strategic part of it is what I was thinking of. I mean, he was always coming up with tricks that nobody had thought of before. For example, he would take his best pinch hitter and bat the guy lead off playing shortstop, and then just put in his shortstop in the bottom of the first. His rationale being a pinch hitter is worth as much in the first as in the ninth. Why not just have this guy start the game off, try to get a hit? And then you put in Mark Belanger, who's a terrible hitter at shortstop.
Right.
And it's the same thing as batting the guy in the ninth. So he was always coming up with like new devices, new, and he also wants, he would have a pitcher in the DH spot far down in the order. And when that DH spot came up, so this would be like a guy on his off day, he would just pick the guy he wanted to actually hit in that at bat. So if the other team changed pitchers or the situation changed, he'd basically have a blank slate at DH.
That's awesome.
And nobody had thought of this. And they actually changed the rule. They said that you start at DH, he has to have one at bat.
Serious baseball guy, which people, you know, as I said, people think of the clown. We have the greatest Oriole fan that I've ever come in contact with, our executive producer, Josh Soroka, who I know has a better depth of knowledge about Orioles baseball than any of us. So, Josh, I'll kick it over to you to talk to
Well, Jonathan. I came after Earl Weaver.
You did? Yeah, because you're a young guy.
There was his return in the 80s when I was a kid. But I hear Jim Palmer talk all the time about how much he respects Earl Weaver, and at the same time sharing stories about him and Earl Weaver just getting into it in the dugout.
They didn't like each other. Well, I think Palmer was the anti-Earl, to be honest with you.
Yes, different. And the photos of them too crack me up because Jim Palmer's got a good 18 inches on Earl.
And he's good looking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's just completely different guys. How was, when you researched player relationships with Earl, I know they all respect him because he's got that winning path. Are there guys out there that just can't get past the relationships?
Yeah, that's a good question. The first thing I want to say, I'm 47, so I grew up in the 80s too, kind of after Earl Weaver was you know, at his peak. And
not me.
I felt like it was like living in Rome in the 5th century and reading about Julius Caesar. I mean, this was like a guy who was on top of the baseball world. And, you know, here I am struggling through the 1988 season where the Orioles lost their first 21 games.
Sure.
And I'm reading about this guy, and the Orioles were the best team in baseball in the 70s. They won the most games. And so I just was insanely curious about how that happened. Anyway, to Josh's question, it was very complicated with the players, very complicated with Jim Palmer. He didn't talk to them, and he sort of treated them with almost contempt, but he didn't hold a grudge. He treated people a lot like men. Very interesting conversation about black players and race with Ken Dixon, who pitched for the Orioles in the 80s. And Kenny told me that other, you know, older white coaches would sort of talk down to him and be condescending. Whereas Earl, I mean, he would curse at you. But Kenny said he treated me like a man. And Earl grew up in a very racist environment. As a young man, he used the N-word. I mean, but he evolved. He helped Frank Robinson become the first black manager. Eddie Murray loved him. Ken Singleton loved him. Ken Dixon loved him. And so because he had this integrity to him, that's what I want to get at, this integrity that even though he was ornery, he was prickly, he was difficult to deal with, he was true to himself and he didn't lie. He didn't make promises he couldn't keep. And so a lot of players, they'd be in conflict with him over the years and like not, you know, not really appreciating him. But at the end of their careers, they look up and say, well, we won with this guy. He didn't play any games. He treated me with respect in his own way. He didn't go behind my back. He didn't rip me to the media. And Palmer credits him for being in the Hall of Fame, even though they had this, you know, love, hate. I call them frenemies in the book. And Palmer, you know, he grew up so wealthy, he learned how to play baseball by playing catch with his butler. And so, you know, here's Palmer.
I didn't know that about Jim
That's
Palmer.
Great.
That's Palmer. A factoid that I love, John. That's amazing.
And like, you know, upper west side of New York City, like he's like a real rich kid. And here's Earl from the hard streets of St. Louis. And, you know, of course they weren't going to get along. It was a class difference, a height difference. But it was so iconic, their relationship. They even wrote a whole book about it called Together We Were 11 Feet 9.
You know, as I listen to you talk about this, I begin to drift off into the entire concept of coaching, not necessarily just baseball, but managing in baseball. When you're talking about the integrity and you're talking about, you hear a lot about relationships and winning coaches having an honest, direct approach to their players. And in baseball, I think no better sport for that than a baseball manager, because these guys, you got so many personalities, so many egos that have been at the top of their game all through every level they played on. The guys that, the word that comes to mind is the balls to just head on deal with these guys. There's a lot of courage involved in being a successful manager, isn't there?
That's correct. That's a very good point. And you know, as part of the book, I live in Pittsburgh, and I would go down to the stadium whenever a visiting team was in town and interview their manager. So I interviewed a dozen current managers and had them reflect on Earl's legacy, had them reflect on what you just said and the job. And one question I asked each of them is, how has this job changed and how has it stayed the same since?
I'd love to hear the answer to that.
Since you were a kid, Mike. So how it's changed is that they now see themselves as middle managers. They're part of these sprawling org charts. They travel with like 75 people, including psychiatrists or therapists, trainers, agents are always there. And they're in the middle of it, trying to like, juggle everything. Like if a player has a bad game, gets hurt, the agent will call. You know, it's all this other stuff to deal with to the point where, you know, maybe Billy Martin or Weaver wouldn't have wanted to deal with this stuff. Okay, but how is it stayed the same? And Craig Counsell told me this, the current manager of the Cubs. He said, you're still dealing with young men with dreams, and they're still like going to have their hearts broken or succeed. And they're still very fragile beneath all the bluster and all the egos. They're fragile and they need support. They need somebody to talk to. And so you're there to help them. And Jim Leland told me this. Jim said, the thing you have in common is not changed is you have to love the players. You have to have this deep respect for what they do, their talent, their athleticism. And Earl had that. Earl was an almost major leaguer. You know, one major league spring training cut on the last day. And so he sort of knew where the bar was because as I said in the book, he was the bar. He, anybody better than Earl Weaver was a big leaguer. And so Earl had this appreciation, this respect for big league baseball players that translated into this integrity and he knew what they could do.
You know, if you're going to be a baseball manager, I totally agree with the idea of loving the players is so very, very important. If you're going to be a successful GM, I think the opposite might be true. Because really, when you think about it, the real cold as ice decisions where these are pawns, numbers, that comes from the GM's office. And it's not necessarily a, you know, a symbiotic relationship between a general manager and a manager. How did Earl...
Everyone's talking about AI these days, right? This season on Compiler, we're diving deep into how AI is reshaping the world we live in. Join us for a new season of Compiler, an original podcast from Red Hat. Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Handle the front office. I would assume it might have been a little hands-off because of his overwhelming success and his popularity.
I mean, back then, this is part of the book too, and this is why this book is called The Last Manager, which obviously is not a literal statement. It's an argument. And the argument is that they were much bigger operators within the game. They were kind of like, I mean, they would have sometimes more responsibility, more power than the GM. The GM, you know, in the early days, like in the 40s, 50s, 60s, he was the guy who organized the train schedules and would, you know, sign the contracts for the concessions. So the first powerful GM was actually Harry Dalton, probably, who was the guy who hired Earl Weaver for the Orioles in 1968. But the managers in the 70s would have more say in trades. They had more say in how the team was run. And I'm actually wearing my Eddie Murray jersey because it was Eddie Murray's birthday yesterday. What a player.
I mean, as a Red Sox fan, I have to tell you, I go down the list of the guys that played for Earl. Eddie Murray at the top of the list. Just not only a great player, but a great personality.
I have an Eddie Murray story that answers your question.
And awesome.
In 1977, Eddie Murray came up with the Orioles in spring training and absolutely raked, had everything in sight. But he was only 21 years old. And Hank Peters, the general manager, he said, you know, I think we should send this guy down to AAA. And Earl said, you know, if he doesn't go north with the team, I'm not going north. So basically, he put his career, his job on the line to have Eddie Murray stay with the Orioles. And Hank Peters folded. He said, okay, Earl, you're the boss. And Eddie went north and was rookie of the year. And by the way, Earl is the classic, again, trick. The DH was a new position then. It was only 4 years old. And all the DHs were these old guys, old sluggers. And nobody had ever thought about having a young guy DH. Well, Earl wanted to break Eddie in and not give him the pressure of playing defense. So he started in the first half of the season at DH. He was everyday DH. For a 21-year-old, that was unheard of. The second half of the season, started playing first base and eventually became the Orioles' full-time first baseman. But he started that Rookie of the Year campaign as a DH, and that was entirely Earl's idea. even to keep him on the team and to DH him.
You know, we're talking the tormented part of the book when you're talking about, and we've talked about an awful lot except for the arguments, but when I see an Earl Weaver argument, especially the classic that the video surfaces all the time, you're here for one reason and one reason only. There is a theatrical element to this that that rivals professional wrestling. But when you watch it, even if it was theatrical, you know at the core, he's pissed. He's pissed. And when you hear the relationships that umpires, would it be safe to say umpires today have to be a little more careful and managers have to be a little bit more careful? Because those are, you know, those are arguments where the umpires just deliberately ramping up the managers. Yeah. And in Earl's case, you know, what'd you get that for? Effing up World Series? I mean, it was amazing. He was an entertainer when it came to that stuff.
Yeah. And the baseball writer Peter Pasquarelli once said, Earl walking out to argue with an umpire was like Elvis walking out in Las Vegas.
So true.
He'd get
ovations in visiting ballparks, right?
It was like professional wrestling. He was the heel. He would come out. And Method was a mixture of things. Like, he would obviously blow his top and be angry. And he had this kind of darkness to him that never really went away, and that he would lose it. He also cared about winning, and he also had a strategic element where he knew it would deflect attention and pressure from the players. And he also wanted to put on a show. And once in a while, he would just tell his coach before going out, you know, watch this. And he would jab his hat down in his head to like make it firmer. So he called it beaking. He'd beak the umpire in the chest. And he would do amazing stunts. Like, he once tore up a rule book on the field, threw it all over the field. He once threw an umpire out of a game. He once sat on home plate like a Buddha. The umpire once offered him a rule book, and Earl said, "I can't read your rule book." And the umpire said, "Why not?" And Earl said, "Because it's in Braille."
That's just classic. And, you know, the word Napoleonic gets thrown around because Earl was such a tiny guy. You just put, you know, I too remember him standing next to Palmer and Doug DeSensei and Mark Belanger and, you know, Don Baylor, these legends. And he's a teeny tiny guy, but, you know, he didn't get the Napoleonic complex that much. He was a good manager.
And I don't think, by the way, I don't think Napoleon would have been a nickname he would have hated. He didn't mind like being called Ayatollah or Son of Sam.
Sure.
For younger viewers, is a reference to a serial killer. But the nickname he really hated was Mickey Rooney. He was a Hollywood actor in the old days. He was very short, and the umpires would say, you know, Rooney, get the hell out of here. And that would really piss Earl off.
That's awesome.
You know, the Howler hot mic, I have a whole chapter about it because it's such an iconic baseball, you know, scene.
Right.
The TV crew, and I talked to the TV crew, and they were doing a series about umpires before the game. And the umpire forgot to take his mic off. And so when Earl went out there and they were packing up their equipment, and they were like, no, wait, we got to hear this. And it was so incredible. They never heard anything like it. And they got the tape. And the Orioles PR guy, John Blake, was so panicked. He saw what had happened. He tried to wrestle the tape away from the sound guy, who I'm told was named Cheese Man. And Cheese Man said, "You ain't getting this effing tape." And so they went back to the studio, and it went viral 80s style, where there was like a bootleg tape that every sports writer had. They would play it at winter meetings. And somebody who heard that tape was Ron Shelton, the Hollywood screenwriter and director. And Ron told me he used that argument to write the scene in Bull Durham where Kevin Costner fights with the umpire. As soon as they start responding to each other, that's when it becomes theater. It's like they have their roles, they have their lines, and they're bouncing off each other. And that tension is theatrical. And that argument, you know, again, everybody should watch it without their children. It's over 3 minutes long. It's like a whole scene.
It really is.
Well, it's like you said, Shakespearean. It all sort of fits in under that Shakespearean umbrella. I have a question. Obviously, Earl sort of bridged two eras of baseball because he was at it for so long. And now they're starting to look at the game of baseball. They have the pitch clock and they're trying to reinvent it. But the most exciting thing in baseball now is the Savannah Bananas. Do you think there's room in the modern era for them to loosen up and return to where they, I mean, there were personalities, even I remember, not a sports fan, like Tommy Lasorda and Billy Martin. They weren't famous, but they could like get on Fantasy Island. So, I mean, are we going to start seeing personalities in the game again?
I think Savannah Bananas is absolutely essential for baseball and for keeping baseball alive and healthy in the culture, because it can't just be like, you know, algorithms and you know, and I love strategic baseball, and I coach high school baseball, and I love statistics. I love all that stuff. But the show is important too. And Earl,
yeah. Amen.
He grew up and younger viewers don't know about this, but the Gas House Gang was this famous team in the 1930s that was so eccentric. They had their own country band. And
was when that they Cleveland? Went on, was that Cleveland?
St. Louis.
St. Louis. Okay.
And when they went on the road, they would play march from their train station to the hotel playing music. And in the off season, they played vaudeville, which was a sort of traveling theater circuit.
Yes.
And Frankie Frisch, the manager, he said, "I feel like we travel with more instruments than baseball equipment." And because they would be on these 15-hour train rides, you know, from St. Louis to New York, and they'd have to entertain themselves. There was no recorded music, no electronic music. And so they would play music themselves. And so Earl's dad did the laundry for the Gas House Gang. So Earl grew up in this culture of baseball's putting on a show.
It should happen.
That was deep within him of the fans have paid their $3, whatever. They deserve to be entertained.
That's awesome. I have to, you know, when we're talking about the entertainment factor, as a purist, there are a couple of things. We had the manager of the Bananas on, and it was an interesting discussion, and I agree with you. Adding to Rob's question, as far as the entertainment aspect, is there a chance that we will see a hybrid? I don't want to say that. Because as a purist, Josh and I have both talked to each other about not liking to watch the Bananas.
I don't like watching.
But I think we desperately need in sports like golf and baseball, some of these, we need an infusion of personality. Mm-hmm. And you teach NFL, NBA, baseball players, you have people that say, this is how you behave, this is how you manage your money, this is what you want to avoid, you want to do that. Don't you? I think maybe if we implemented a little, remember, you're entertainers, show a little life out there, show a little personality. I don't know how you get there with the way baseball is right now, how you bridge that gap between the Savannah Bananas insanity and, you know, the swagger of baseball players just walking around and trying to look cool.
It's tricky. And the answer has to do with money, I think. I mean, I used to cover corporations for the Wall Street Journal, and anytime you have a lot of money at stake, the guy at the top is very paranoid about anybody saying anything that's going to reflect badly on the brand or the company.
Yep.
And so the player who's making his $5 million, I mean, he might be really funny and charismatic and provide great copy 100 days a year, but it's the one day where he says something stupid, and we all say dumb things sometimes. Mm-hmm. And that then becomes a problem, an image problem for the whole baseball club or organization. And so then the general manager says, well, no, you know, you say these 7 cliches and go home. One thing I loved about this project was I interviewed these ball players from the 70s, you know, guys who were in their 60s, 70s, and they didn't care. They were happy to just tell the stories and be honest and talk about, you know, the drinking and the fights, whatever it was.
Right.
And I just loved it. I thought it was so refreshing. I've been in current major league clubhouses, and it's mostly very boring. I mean,
that's so dull.
They just say the same stuff over and over again.
Well, I've watched spring training evolve over the years down here in Fort Myers, where it used to be the starters. You could literally walk up to the guys, and now it's kind of like, you know, it coincides with the netting that went up around the entire ballpark. You know, there's that barrier now between the fans and the players. Josh, I'm going to give you the last question because you are the Oriole fan of Oriole fans.
And I wanted to add to what you're saying, because in Baltimore, we saw a little bit of that personality come out with Buck Showalter.
Yep.
In the post game
old school
conferences with that old school move. And I think we're seeing that move right now in Baltimore with there are so many young guys on the team and young players that have grown up with social media and kind of understand that relationship that's where you're going to see more baseball personalities come out.
I'd like to see it on the field too.
I think you're seeing it on the field a little bit. because, at least in Baltimore, because they're all 22-year-olds that have been friends for years. And you're seeing that friendship, and that's exciting younger Oriole fans with some personality. I find it very interesting that outside of Baltimore, Earl is known for these rants and raves. And in Baltimore, there's so much respect with still growing tomatoes in Camden Yards for him.
Yep.
And talking about what makes a good manager and always focusing on that pitch and defense in the three-run homer. Has that, that's something that then every manager relies on? Because, or is that just a Baltimore thing that I grew up with that ingrained in me?
I mean, no, he changed the strategic direction of the sport. I mean, basically every manager after Earl has tried to manage like Earl. I mean, in the book, I say he made his own job obsolete because after Earl, you could just program a computer to manage like Earl. Because he was so right about so many things. I mean, he prioritized on-base percentages in the 1960s. He realized that intentional walks and bunts were not winning strategies. Early in his career, he actually bunted a lot, partly because he had Mark Belanger, who was a terrible hitter. But he just, like, what was amazing about
it's
him...
It's a second dig on Mark Belanger, John, that you've got.
I think Mark Belanger...
I smell that you might not like Belanger.
I think Belanger should be in the Hall of Fame. Here's my...
Oh,
that's my,
okay. All right.
That's my good. Controversial take.
There you go.
He's the third best defender by defensive wins above replacement of all time.
Mm-hmm.
But back to Josh's point, yeah, I mean, Earl evolved. And that's what's also incredible about him as a character is that he was always thinking about things, adapting. The first time that women came into the clubhouse, he didn't react well. He evolved. He'd apologize. He got to know them. Like, he just was always, like, reconsidering himself.
Get that skirt out of here. Yeah, get that skirt out of here now.
Yeah. But he had a capacity for self-reflection. That's why, you know, his memoir is called It's What You Learn After You Know It All That Counts.
Yeah.
And so, managers, I mean, they all revere Earl still. Like, these conversations I had in the clubhouses a couple years ago, they all still see him as a winner. And that's the thing, too. They also talk about his passion for winning. And that's the human element that transcends the statistics and the strategy. I mean,
yep.
He had this singular focus, and he cared so much. And I think that's what's so cool about him is that as a leader, he could be messy, he could pass out, you know, drunk, but because he cared so much, he would inspire people to play well. And you know, when you were a kid, he came back in '85 and '86, Josh, he had lost that passion, and he had stopped caring, and those teams were not successful.
Yep.
And it really highlights also right. How great he was in the 70s when he was at the top of his game, when he did care.
That is that's a great way to end it here. And the book is The Last Manager, John W. Miller. I mean, I just think that what a great subject and a
wonderful.
Great book about an American original unlike any other, and one of the best figures, not in just baseball, but all of sport. The book is fantastic. Good luck with it. I don't think you need any luck. And I would say let's go O's, but I have no intention of saying that on this show.
Let's go O's. I can say
let's go O's.
I think we'll convert that into a button now. I'll pull that audio.
John W. Miller, thanks for joining us and talking about Earl Weaver. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. John. Have a good day.
That's John Miller. And
you know,
and by the way,
miss.
John Miller, another John Miller, a great voice of the Orioles who I yes. knew. And John Miller, who does to this day one of the best impressions of Vin Scully, who's no longer
oh,
with
wow.
us.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's great. I love
the
baseball.
The book is a great book, but Miller did miss one thing, is I really thought in the dedication he would tell Alice Sweet the right time to put in a tomato.
I'm not a fan of that tape. I am a fan, as you know, always.
I know.
Of the, and maybe on the bonus show this week, we can just revisit that wonderful, you're here for one reason, and one reason, it's the great, I think the greatest baseball argument I've ever seen. It's fantastic.
I do like the manager's corner because it was just passed around on audio tape.
Yeah, and it was it was him doing shtick, just pure shtick.
How people just love the guy.
But right. even as shtick, he's one of the best users of swear words I've ever heard.
They all, in those days,
they
those
knew
guys
how to do it. Wow.
Could paint. Mm-hmm. And by the way, if Earl was here, he would love Josh dropping his consonants. Just wanted to say that. We have to take a break.
Okay.
Yes, Josh, you were going to add something.
Oh, I was going to say, go out to Camden Yards and stand by those statues and you can see how small Earl was.
He was elfin-like.
With the statues, Palmer's got his leg kicked up, like in his pitching motion, and I think his leg is above Earl's head. that.
Oh, my God.
Absolutely true. We'll take a break. Come back with the roundtable right here on the Mike O'Mara Show. You know.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.